Good morning and welcome. We're very lucky to have with us this week, through next Sunday, Jonathan Landau. He has been a Buddhist practitioner since 1970 when he first met Lama Yeshe, one of the founders of our mother organization. He's been here for the past week doing some really wonderful teachings. He's very knowledgeable. He's the author of Buddhism for Dummies. You have to know a little bit of something to write for dummies, I guess. This week, besides today, he will be completing this afternoon the weekend workshop on the 7-point mind training. And even if you haven't come earlier, you're welcome to stay for that starting at 1:30 this afternoon. Tomorrow night, he will be teaching the first session in the Discovering Buddhism module on how to meditate. Wednesday, he's going to be teaching again on the foundation of all good qualities, which is kind of a very concise Lam Rim text. Thursday, this will be very interesting. He's doing a presentation about making pilgrimage to Buddhist holy sites, and he's been to all the sites that he's going to be covering, so that'll be really interesting. Saturday morning, he'll be doing a presentation about the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, which is both adult-friendly and children-friendly. And then next Sunday, he'll be back here in the Gampa for the Sunday morning teachings. We're really, really lucky to have him here. He's very well-spoken and articulate, and as I said, he's extremely knowledgeable. Of course, as those of you who are familiar with Kanapa Center are aware, everything that we offer at the center, we offer on a donation basis. We never charge for teachings because they're so important. We don't want money to be an obstacle. Money can be an obstacle to us in the real world, so if you are enjoying what you're hearing and would like to support having John here, we would welcome any donations, which you can make in the bookstore or in any of the boxes here, or you can also go online. Thank you, and he'll be in just a moment. Okay, we will begin on page 183 in the Gold Prayer Book, or on the page of text in the White Notebook with Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. Jaya ta recite the four immeasurables in English. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then we flip the page, and at the bottom of page 37, we'll chant the four immeasurables in Tibetan, followed by eight recitations of Chenrezig's mantra and seven recitations of Green Tara's mantra. Sem Chen Tam Che De Wa Dong. Thank you. chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai tu chai tu e sa ho ha om chai. Okay, the children can go to their classes now.
Donna, did you want to make the announcement now or later?
I actually did remind people ahead of time, but I'll just repeat it at the very end.
At the end, okay.
Yeah.
So, very, very nice to be back with you since last week. How many people were here last week, last Sunday? Oh, very nice. So, as those of you who are here might remember, I spoke a lot nonstop last time, and then at the end only left time for one question. But it was a whopper of a question, so I didn't feel too bad about that. So this time, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, at least my intention, is to say a few words about some verses in Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, but not too much extensive commentary, just a few minutes, and then leave it open to whatever it is that you'd like to discuss, whatever's on your mind, whatever questions you have. I can't guarantee that I'd be able to answer all the questions you have. I can't even answer all of my own questions, but if there is something that interests you, and I think I can shed a little bit of light on it, I would be very happy to do that. In fact, that's what I like most of all, is to find out what's on people's minds. And since I don't have clairvoyance, the only way I can know that is by you telling me what you're thinking about and what questions you may have. Okay? So, as was pointed out last time, the last teachings that Geshe La gave on the Sunday morning Dharma teachings, he was discussing some verses in the chapter on joyous effort or enthusiastic perseverance in Shantideva's text, The Bodhisattva's Way of Life. How many people have been here for a period of time, like several weeks or months, listening to Geshe La's Sunday morning teaching on Shantideva? So quite a few of you know what I'm speaking about. That on that text, Shantideva is outlining the practices of a bodhisattva, the cultivation of bodhicitta, and specifically focusing on the six perfections. And of these six perfections, which start with generosity, ethical discipline, patience, enthusiastic perseverance, concentration, and wisdom. Was that six? I think I may have skipped one. That's the perfection of forgetfulness. So of those, the fourth, joyous effort or enthusiastic perseverance, was the topic of the last chapter that Geshe La was teaching on, and he had reached, I was told, of course I wasn't here, he had reached stanza 32 in the text. And so I would like to make some comments on the stanzas that follow from 32, specifically in this particular section, and I think it goes from stanzas 33 to about 68 or 69, that group of stanzas, what Shantideva is particularly talking about are the factors which increase this practice of joyous effort or enthusiastic perseverance. You know, what strengthens it, what makes it, what allows us to actually do this practice, perfect this practice. Okay, and he starts by outlining four qualities, and that's what I'll have a few words to say about this morning. Does anyone remember from your own reading what these four qualities are? Anybody remember from not having read it? Anyone? I think it's helpful, just as a suggestion, especially for those people who attend Geshe La's teachings with some regularity, is to look ahead in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, if you have a copy of it, just to read, you know, a few stanzas ahead. Then you have some preparation for what it is that Geshe La comments on. So you kind of have a framework, so it's not hitting you all new. You're at least familiar with some of the words of the explanation. And this allows us to get into a deeper understanding of whatever commentary Geshe La gives. Okay? So if you do have that text, if you are able to look at that text, you'll see that around stanzas 32 and 33, there's a list of these four qualities. So first I'll just say the names of these four particular factors which increase the strength of this enthusiastic perseverance, and then I'll try to limit myself to just a few words about each one. Okay? So the first one is called aspiration. Aspiration. And I guess you could, if you wanted a synonym for that, aspiration is a wish. Right? Okay? Then the second, after aspiration, is steadfastness. Steadfastness. Then the fourth is joy. Joy. And finally, rest. Rest. Or as Elmer Fudd would say, west and relaxation. Okay. So, aspiration, steadfastness, joy, and rest. And all of these are aimed at fortifying, strengthening this practice of joyous effort. And the practice of joyous effort itself is designed to overcome the different forms of laziness. Okay? And laziness itself is often, as many of these perfections are, is described in three parts. There's three aspects of laziness that can be talked about. I hope I can remember them all. One is very often what we ordinarily think of as laziness, and that is, you know, procrastination. Just we have a job to do, and instead of doing it now, we put it off until later. And that's kind of a general run-of-the-mill definition of laziness, both in the worldly sense, you know, in our ordinary day-to-day activities, and in the Dharma sense. So joyous effort, enthusiastic perseverance, helps banish the fault of such laziness, such procrastination. Okay. The next form of laziness doesn't look like laziness. Right. It could be excessive effort that we put into ordinary mundane activities. You know, so if you see someone bustling around and really taking care of the house and the garden and the car and all of these things and all this activity that he or she is engaging in, we wouldn't normally think of that person as lazy. We would normally think of that person as extremely energetic, right? The person who's, you know, kind of sitting in the corner just relaxing, we might think that person's lazy. But the person engaging in all those activities, we would think, oh, that's the opposite of laziness. But from a Dharma point of view, exerting all our effort into areas which at most can only give us a very brief temporary respite from suffering, a brief experience of a mundane pleasure, and neglecting spiritual practice, which has the ability to give us lasting happiness and a sense of well-being, all the way up to liberation and enlightenment, that kind of energy devoted solely to mundane pursuits, from the Dharma point of view, is a form of laziness. Right? So here the word laziness is being used to describe something which to the world doesn't seem to be lazy at all. Right? But if it prevents that person from actually engaging in serious spiritual pursuits, then it is laziness. Okay? It's indulging in activities which are, from a wider point of view, fruitless, meaningless. Okay? Now, I want to hasten to add, one can engage in worldly activities, like the ones I just described, with a Dharma motivation. And in that case, then, it's not laziness. Right? Any activity that you see anyone engaging in could be the activity of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. What makes the difference between an action which is just a mundane pursuit and therefore a form of laziness as described here and a valuable a Dharma action is, as is always the case, the motivation behind it, right? So one can perform even the most worldly actions with a very powerful, loving, compassionate bodhicitta motivation, and then it's no longer laziness. It may look like the same mundane actions that anyone else engages in, but because the motivation is different, then that definitely would not be considered laziness. Okay? Do you see the distinction between that? Okay. That's one of the reasons why the teachers are always pointing out it's very, very hard to judge others, right? Because even others who may be engaged in ordinary worldly activities, who might just simply be goofing off, who might even be engaging in harmful activities, some of them might be Buddhas and Bodhisattvas demonstrating some aspect of the spiritual path to us, right? So since we don't know the motivation, it's very, very hard to judge someone by their outward actions, okay? But of course, ourselves, you know, the point is that we're not in the business of judging others. We're in the business of rectifying our own state of mind. And so we can look inwards and find out, what is the motivation behind my action? Am I doing this action for the welfare of others, or is this just another way of killing time? Just another way of bolstering my ego. That we can discern. Okay? But judging others, very tricky to do. Very hard to know. Because the outward activity is not necessarily a sign of the inward motivation. Okay? So that was two of the laziness. The laziness of procrastination and the laziness of, let's say, indulging in mundane activity. To give it a phrase. And then the third one, I wonder if anyone here knows or remembers what the third form of laziness is, as it's generally described in the Lamrim teachings. Anyone?
Thinking that you're not worthy of it or something.
Okay. To repeat, thinking that you're not worthy. Another way of saying the same thing is delusions of incapability. Delusions of incapability. Having the feeling like, oh, maybe there's other great practitioners and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so forth, but I can't possibly do that. I can't possibly engage in actions similar to those of a great Bodhisattva. I can't do it. I'm not capable of it, right? And so that's a very defeatist attitude, this feeling of incapability. And against that, we have to keep in mind that the Buddha himself has said, and other great masters have reiterated, that all beings, every being that possesses a mind, has the potential to become fully enlightened. Just the fact that we possess awareness, there's nothing inherently keeping that awareness covered and restricted. And therefore, when any of the coverings or restrictions that are there are removed, and the good qualities like loving kindness and compassion and wisdom and so forth are fully developed, the mind becomes a fully awakened mind, a mind of a Buddha, a fully developed being like that. So that potential for full enlightenment is in all beings, not just all human beings, but all beings without exception. And we can also see that because our state of mind is impermanent, that if we apply spiritual training to it, there's no reason why we can't progressively decrease the strength of our delusions and our negativities and increase the strength of whatever positive qualities we have. So that taken, you know, especially if we think in very long stretches of time, remember the Buddha said it took him 3 countless great eons to attain enlightenment from the moment he developed the wish to become enlightened, right? And that's a huge amount of time. So especially if we think we've got all of this time to do it in, then there's no reason to think that we can't attain enlightenment. And even if enlightenment is too far in the distant and too remote to think, we can certainly increase the strength of our positive qualities. All the way to enlightenment? That's a big thing to ask for. Possible, but maybe a little bit daunting. But certainly we can expand the scope of our love, the scope of our compassion, the depth of our wisdom. All of these things can be increased. And as for the negative qualities on our mind, the presence of anger, like if we have a real short fuse and are always blowing our top like that, or the strength of our greedy attachments, or the strength of our jealousy, or any of the other delusions, these can be diminished over time. They can be diminished, and it may take a long time for them to be eradicated completely. That would be an extraordinary accomplishment. We would be then a foe destroyer, an arhat, a saint. That might be a huge accomplishment. But the steady diminishment of the strength of these delusions, that's definitely possible. And if we are practicing Dharma with a certain amount of, well, enthusiastic perseverance, then we should start noticing some changes over a period of weeks and months and years, which then gives us the encouragement that removes this laziness of incapability. We see we've been able to make some progress. Okay? So those are the 3 types of laziness which enthusiastic perseverance helps overcome. And then now just to say a few words about each of these 4 factors that increase the strength of this perseverance, that help us overcome these forms of laziness. Okay, so the first one was aspiration, the wish to cultivate this quality. Mm-hmm. In Shantideva's text, he talks about recognizing that we have a very precious opportunity to do something meaningful with our life. You've probably received teachings on what's known as the precious human rebirth. or the perfect human rebirth, sometimes it's called, that we have the mental and physical and cultural wherewithal to really engage in significant spiritual practice, Dharma pursuits. But Shantideva points out that if we check up, we might discover that we have been frittering this precious opportunity away on fundamentally meaningless activities, and that it hasn't led to any stable experience of peace of mind or stability or happiness, right? Whereas if we were to devote ourselves to spiritual practices, Dharma practices, with the same kind of enthusiasm that we've been devoting to just ordinary mundane activities, then we would be able to attain all of the wholesome factors that are described in the Dharma texts. We would be able to cultivate the same qualities that we admire, for example, in our teachers, who have qualities of radiant love and compassion and the ability to cut through confusion with wisdom and the knowledge of how to help other beings. That if we applied the same kind of effort to the spiritual practices that we do to ordinary mundane practices, then instead of continually kind of going around in circles, we would actually be making progress in the direction of spiritual perfection. We can see how our ordinary involvement with unwholesome activities lead only to suffering, whereas if we were to cultivate these spiritual practices, then we would be able to experience true peace of mind and a lasting sense of well-being. And in Shantideva's text, he specifically draws the distinction between being continually reborn in one realm after another within samsara, within cyclic existence, looking for happiness but experiencing just repeated uncontrolled misery. He contrasts that with a spiritual practitioner who can actually, even before the attainment of full enlightenment, achieve rebirth in a pure land. And he mentions specifically the pure land of Amitabha Buddha, the Western paradise, where if that's a state of being outside of samsara, in which everything is conducive for attaining enlightenment, and that is, it's possible for us to attain rebirth in such a pure realm. And so he makes this very sharp contrast between the ordinary world, or the ordinary realms that we are circling in, and this pure land rebirth that's possible as a result of Dharma practice. So by pointing out the great difference between the frustrations and dissatisfactions of one and the lasting happiness and good qualities of the other, then by thinking of that, it increases our aspiration, increases that first quality of wishing to devote ourselves to these spiritual practices with true enthusiastic perseverance. Okay? Then the second power that helps build up this enthusiastic perseverance is steadfastness. And this can be abbreviated in just a simple statement. It's a matter of having self-confidence in our practice, in whatever it is that we're doing, whatever Dharma practice we may be doing, having a sense of self-confidence in it. And we can gain this by making a determination to complete whatever it is we've started. Not to indulge in the habit of starting a little bit of this and then leaving it aside and then doing a little bit of that and leaving it aside, but making a realistic decision of a practice that we feel that we can devote ourselves to and then just stay with it. That's what steadfastness is. And from that point of view, we can build up that sense of self-confidence. To give an example from another sphere, I was working on a text quite a number of years ago. I had a contract with a publisher to publish a particular book, and I reached a point where I just had so much to do, you know, that I fell into this state of kind of despair. I almost felt like I had to tell them, take back the contract. There's no way that I can finish this work. But fortunately, there was a woman at the publishing company. I never met her, but we just had phone contact and through emails. And she said, well, John, just cut off a reasonable amount and work on that until you've got that much done. And then cut off another reasonable amount and just work on that until you have that done. And it was actually very simple, but very extraordinary advice. It was very, very helpful. And in fact, it's something I have to continually remind myself, because the laziness of procrastination and incapability is very strong in my mind, you know. So when I have to do a project, I often fall into that kind of semi-despairing state. But when I can remember what she told me, that divide the task up into manageable bite size, and then work on each of those until you've completed it. Don't just have trouble with this and then move over to that. I can't do chapter 3, so let's work on the index for a while and then go back to chapter 4. Instead of jumping around, taking something, once you started it, once they've started it, continue it through. So that sense of steadfastness is a great help for joyous effort, because also we get continual rewards. At the end of the day, we can say, oh, I did that much. Whereas my ordinary work habits are so slovenly that at the end of a week, I've got nothing to show for it. But this way, at least I have got a paragraph done. Well, that's a paragraph that wasn't done last week, right? And one can build up. So we can apply that same attitude of completing whatever it is that we've started. As long as we're realistic in what we've chosen, we don't want to choose the most difficult part of the task, because that would probably tend to defeat us. It's too much. We're trying to swallow too much. So that's why it should be kind of bite-sized pieces. And then we can be steadfast. Then the third quality, which increases the strength of this enthusiastic perseverance, is joy itself. Just simply taking pleasure in the task at hand, instead of looking at it as onerous, as work, as another burden. Think of the value, the benefit of it. And it's certainly, if the subject matter is Dharma, you know, which is meant to give us a clear idea of the workings of the mind and a clear ability to distinguish between those kinds of actions and those kinds of attitudes which are limited and lead only to suffering and dissatisfaction, and those which actually lead to some element of enlightenment. If not full attainment of enlightenment, at least the increase in the good qualities, then we realize, oh, this is something to take joy in, to really rejoice that I have the opportunity to spend whatever time it is on working on my mind. And I don't know if it's particularly helpful to people, but sometimes making a comparison between the Dharma work that we're doing and the other kind of work that we could be doing or that so many other people are engaged in, right? Sometimes seeing that comparison can be very helpful. You know, there are people who expend an awful lot of energy engaging in activities which even though those activities are painful, you know, like someone who's training for the Olympics, for example, who practices for hours a day in exercises and types of things which are very, very strenuous physically and mentally, right? In order to have the hopes of winning, you know, a medal at the Olympics, right? Well, many of the people who spend all that effort end up with no medals at all, right? And then the people who end up with the medals, they end up with a medal, right? So they have a piece of metal hanging in their bedroom. Okay? So you think of the enthusiastic perseverance that someone might expend for activities like that with kind of very limited results, and our, you know, that can encourage us to take joy in the fact that we're engaging in a process which, even though it may take a long time, we end up with more than just a medal on the wall, right? We end up being a transformed being, you know, a being who can effortlessly and spontaneously benefit others. Even before we attain full enlightenment, we can be extraordinarily beneficial not only to ourselves but to others. So just taking joy in our activities. And then the last one, and I have a very, very clear memory of when I first received teachings on Shantideva and my teacher, Geshe Ngawang Targe at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, reached this point. He said, because at this point, what Shantideva is saying, one of the important factors to cultivate in order to develop this enthusiastic perseverance is rest. And it sounded so unusual that here was this great spiritual master advising us to take it easy, you know. Rest. Well, I can do that. I've got the perfection of rest and relaxation. Right? But within the context of these teachings, it had profound meaning. You know, it was recognizing. Well, actually, we can translate it into terminology which I don't think was very popular when I was first studying this text many years ago, but we hear it all the time now. Burnout. You know, people engaged in social work, hospital work, health professions, things like that. Many people like that, very, very dedicated, good-hearted people. But after a while, they seem to be almost digging themselves into a grave because they're experiencing burnout. And so what Shantideva says, know when to rest, know when to relax, know when to step back. Because without stepping back occasionally, then we lose that sense of freshness. But rest and relaxation, when properly applied, allows us to refresh ourselves. So again, if we see someone just, you know, leaning back on a, you know, on a couch or resting by the side of a pool or whatever it is, we might think, well, that person isn't doing very much. That person seems to be rather lazy. But it could be a case where this person is actively engaged in benefiting others, but is reaching the point where if he or she were to continue, burnout would be a problem. Recognizing this is now relaxing, right? Is taking a break. So it looks like taking a break, even has the outward aspect of laziness, right? Doesn't seem to be enthusiastic perseverance at all. Seems to be diametrically opposed to enthusiastic perseverance, you know, just lounging around, may actually be engaging in a practice which allows him or her to go back to the Dharma activity with renewed vigor, refreshed mind, with more energy. Okay? So, that's just a few words to talk about these four qualities which we can cultivate in the process of practicing this this perfection, this fourth perfection of sometimes called joyous effort or enthusiastic perseverance. Okay? And just to repeat, if you want to look at the verses in which this is, in which Shantideva is talking about these qualities, it starts on 32 and 33 in that chapter. I think it's the seventh chapter, and then continues through to about 67 or 68. So if you'd like to look up those verses, or there are texts which have commentaries to it, that would be the area. And then I can't predict what Geshe La will teach, what he'll resume teaching when he comes back, but it's likely that he'll continue somewhere in that area. If he had left off just before it, he might. And then when he asks you a question and you know the answer, he'll be very happy. Okay. So, we have all the rest of our time together, about 45 minutes. And if there's anything that you'd like to bring up, I'd be very happy to try to address it. And just as a reminder, we always have to wait for the microphone to reach us. So this is an Olympic event. It's kind of like passing the baton. It's passing the microphone. Okay. Yes.
Yes. I had two questions, but I think you answered my second question, so I'm just going to let that go.
Oh.
All
right. Well, that was efficient.
I got to hold it closer. All right. Yeah. Yeah, it was efficient.
Thank you.
Yeah. The other one is on a bodhisattva.
Yeah.
And I believe you said that a bodhisattva is a person who has the mind to achieve enlightenment and is motivated to help others achieve enlightenment.
Yeah.
A bodhisattva is someone who has attained bodhicitta.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oftentimes we say to people, or we will call someone because they're doing like really kind and wonderful things for others, but we will call them bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
That's
a very kind of general thing that people say. Oh, what a bodhisattva, he's helping others. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So that is my question. Is bodhisattva something like that you achieve at some point or by doing these things, and going with this definition, a person who has the mind to achieve enlightenment and is motivated to help others achieve enlightenment, would that make a person a bodhisattva without, you know what I'm trying to say?
I think I do. I think I do. I'll try to respond to that, and if I miss the point, then you have another chance to correct me.
Yes.
Okay. First of all, in the definition of bodhisattva, a being whose mind is intent on attaining enlightenment, I think what you said at the end was, and to help others attain enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, that is, basically, we could say, to achieve enlightenment in order to benefit others. And then there's a whole range of ways in which we can benefit others, and the final culmination of the benefit is to lead them on the path to their enlightenment, right? But a bodhisattva is not limited just in leading them to enlightenment, but in helping them in whichever way is in fact helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's not limited like that, but it goes all the way up to leading them along the path to enlightenment in recognition that we all have this potential to achieve enlightenment. So if we want to make our life truly worthwhile and meaningful, we should use it in order to gain the highest goal that's possible. And since the highest possible goal is enlightenment, that would be the best way of helping others. But a bodhisattva will help others in whichever way is appropriate to their situation at this moment. Okay? So, and then you mentioned that very often just speaking in a very general manner, we see someone engaged in a helpful activity And we might say or think, oh, what a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard ourselves say that or our teachers say that and so forth. Well, this is not necessarily a strictly accurate statement, but it is a recognition that that kind of beneficial activity is the kind of activity a bodhisattva does, right? Doing a kind activity doesn't make one a bodhisattva, however, right? Because people are helping each other all the time, so not everyone who helps somebody else is a bodhisattva, right? There has to be an attainment connected, you know, something attained in the mind of that person so that he can officially be stamped a bodhisattva. And what has to be present is this motivation called the bodhicitta, which is the mind that is intent on attaining enlightenment for the sake of helping others. So, for example, if we go out in the park with some peanuts and we feed some pigeons, well, we're benefiting the birds, right? But unless we're doing that with the thought, just as now I'm giving you food, in the future may I lead you along the path to enlightenment, we're not doing it with bodhicitta. We're doing it with compassion. You know, it's a loving heart. It's excellent. It emulates the deeds of a bodhisattva. It has all these great qualities. But the actual mind of bodhicitta has to be present for the person doing it to officially or legally be called a bodhisattva. Right? Does that make sense? But very often, and this is true in a lot of areas of the Dharma teachings, a name is given. Let's see if I can say this correctly. A name is applied to a situation. The future accomplishment is applied to the present cause. In other words, it's called taking the result into the path. Okay. It's a little hard to put into words, as you just experienced. But what I mean by this is, okay, the person who's just feeding pigeons or helping others or doing whatever kind action is not yet a bodhisattva, right? But is engaged in the kind, loving, helpful activities that are part and parcel of what a bodhisattva does. So by continuing doing those practices and cultivating all of the various spiritual qualities and developing the bodhicitta, this person will eventually, or, you know, following along on this, will eventually truly have the bodhicitta as their primary consciousness and will then be a bodhisattva. So at the moment, the person isn't strictly speaking a bodhisattva, right? But is engaging in the actions which can lead in that same direction. So we apply the future result, when they actually are a bodhisattva, to the present state in which they may be just aspiring to be bodhisattva, or maybe they even haven't heard what it is to be bodhisattva, but they like to practice love and kindness and generosity and compassion, and therefore they're applying the future attainment to the state in which the person has not yet attained bodhisattvahood or bodhicitta, right? So even though it's a kind of a loose way of speaking, just to call anyone who's kind a bodhisattva, it has meaning behind it, because it's showing that it's part of a spectrum, you know, a continuum. And any virtuous action that we engage in can be thought of as an earlier stage on the development of the path all the way to enlightenment. You know? And of course that gives encouragement, because otherwise we might feel like we hear stories about extraordinary activities of real bodhisattvas, what they're able to accomplish. And it can be, instead of being encouraging, it can be discouraging, thinking, I could never do that, you know. But if we recognize that even the small actions of kindness that we do, if we can motivate correctly, become the causes of that enlightenment, then it's much more comfortable. We don't have to beat each other and say, oh, what a poor meditator I am, you know, what a poor practitioner, I can't do this, I'll never be able to do that. Instead, we take joy in those kind, thoughtful, beneficial activities we can engage in, and then, through our aspiration, we make it part of the growing bodhicitta motivation. Okay? Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's very good. So I think what you're saying then, like these acts of kindness, compassion, mm-hmm. generosity, and so mm-hmm. forth, mm-hmm. are like practice to actually achieve. It's kind of like a pianist, right? He plays these notes, mm. and then eventually, by doing the practice, he eventually actually becomes mm-hmm. a great pianist.
Yeah, part of it, I mean, we do talk about practicing the Dharma, which, just like practicing a violin or practicing the piano, is we just get further and further familiarity, deeper and deeper familiarity with the elements that make up the spiritual path. So it is like a practice, mm-hmm. A rehearsal, you know, for the attainment. But we should also keep in mind that it's not only that, but as we're engaged in those activities, other beings are benefiting. So not only are we moving closer to the attainment of some spiritual ideal, fruition, but in the course of it, other beings are being benefited. And that's what our aspiration is.
Thank you very much. That's good.
Thank you. Oh, don't give it to Don. Not to Don. No, he's been saving this question from 20 years. He knew I couldn't answer it 20 years ago, and now he's going to ask it again in front of all of these people because he just wants to embarrass me. So all the rest of you guys, you can close your ears. You don't have to listen to
How this. Did you know?
Hey,
so, this is a question that plagues all of us. I even heard the Dalai, His Holiness, speak to this recently, the subject of loneliness.
Loneliness?
Loneliness. Mm. And, you know, he was talking about how sometimes even he experiences loneliness as I'm the Dalai Lama, and, you know, and then, of course, he has his own ways to get out of that. At least this is what he says. So, but I think it's a question that comes up a lot for all of us, and I think there's a huge, you know, social media to get us connected, yet people say it only makes them more lonely, and,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that, you know, people are involved in endless activities to sort of, including addictions of various
yeah.
types, to combat this issue.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what your thoughts were about a good Dharma solution for this.
Mm-hmm. Without being flippant in my response, I think the answer is helping others. You know, there's a lot of people who fall into some kind of despair or loneliness or fragmentation of their life, and then it starts to become, you know, like a spiraling in, you know, like the water going down the drain. It's like that. We kind of feel that in our heart. And the only thing that's really going to help it is to change the direction of that spiraling, you know, up to a point we've been involuted. Now we have to evolve, right? And the best way, I think, the best way of opening up and changing the direction of that descent into despair is to open our hearts to others, you know, bring to mind, or, and even better, actually practice making contact with someone who needs some kind of help. And it could be any kind of help, right? It could be volunteer work at a hospital, or it could just be giving a listening ear to somebody on a park bench who seems to be in a bad state, you know? And that willingness to get outside of ourselves and really give our attention and time and energy to someone else, I think that's probably the best solution to loneliness. But maybe someone else has, you know, a wider or deeper answer to that. But that's what comes up to my mind. Is that okay, Don?
His holiness answer was not different from that, but just that feeling when he experiences that, it's you know, the energy is definitely focused on this one, but when he focuses on how he's interconnected with everyone,
yeah,
that's a big, again, the energy is flowing out, not in.
Yeah.
In the same way that when we help others, the energy is flowing out, not in.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, or quote His Holiness as saying that, because first, when you asked the question, I was thinking, well, just remember the fact that we are interconnected with everyone. Even if we're alone, we're never completely separate. You know, our food, our clothing, everything depends on others. So just bring to mind the interconnectedness. But one of the reasons I decided not to go in that direction with my response was that's kind of like a mental exercise. You know, mentally I'm feeling isolated, so mentally I should remind myself that I'm actually connected with everyone else. And then just knowing my own experience, that, as powerful as that is, it's not as powerful as actually being generous to somebody else. You know, that's not an intellectual exercise. That actually starts to make a connection with another being, an animal or a human being like that. So I think those two answers fit together. But against my normal predilection, I decided to go with the more practical ones. Thank you. Yes.
Hi. The word expectations.
Expectation.
Just with loneliness or our own journey in life and expectations of, you know, what loneliness or happiness is. And somebody could love you, but you're not feeling like they're loving you the way you want to be loved.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, or your journey in enlightenment, you are expecting to be here, but your, you know, expectations is a big word in all the meaning of that and how it affects everybody in life. I don't know if it's not a question, but it's just a thought and something to ponder in life. And your own expectations and other people's expectations of you.
I don't know if you want to add to that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know in virtually all of the Dharma books and I've read and talks that I've attended and listened to, there's a warning against holding on to expectations. And one of the reasons is that they're highly unrealistic. You know? It's a supposition about something that might happen. And often, it doesn't feel that way. Often, it feels very solid. And so I just go back again to that quotation by Lama Yeshe, which I've mentioned, I think, a couple of times since I've been here at Kadampa Center. Lama Yeshe used to say that whenever we hold on to a fixed idea about something, we are hallucinating. Okay? So an expectation can be a fixed idea of what the result is going to be of a particular action or a particular situation. Right? Now, and the stronger we hold on to it, you know, the clearer the picture that we draw for ourselves of what we expect to happen, the more we've entered cloud cuckoo land. You know, it has nothing to do with the fact that things change from moment to moment, and that we don't know all of the factors that go into the situation, that it certainly may not happen the way we expect. It may happen that it happens the way we expect, but we don't get the feeling from it. We thought, oh, if that were to happen, then I'd feel great. Well, maybe if it doesn't happen, we feel disappointed. But if it does happen, we can feel more disappointed because it doesn't bring the reward that we thought it would. So expectations are really a few steps removed from reality. But, you know, we have the expression unreasonable expectations, which gives us the idea that there could be reasonable expectations. Okay. Well, I think if we're soft enough in our approach, we can entertain reasonable expectations, meaning I'm not guaranteeing for myself that this is going to happen 100%, but it's likely, based on things that have happened in the past, that if I do this and this now, that and that will happen in the future, right? But as soon as we think, well, I've done this, I'm definitely going to get that, you know, right? As soon as we make it a kind of a definite statement, a real expectation, now we're entering into the area of unrealistic expectations. We're entering into the area of hallucination, you know, of substituting for this messy, ever-changing reality that we live in, you know, in which many, many causes come together and conditions come together to produce results. And we only know a fraction of those, right? Substituting for that kind of messy, ever-changing reality, we're substituting an idea of definite. I did this, I'm going to get that. That's my expectation. And with that, we're only setting ourselves up for disappointment. Okay? So if we, you know, be a little bit soft with ourselves, soft with our thinking, soft in the right way, I mean, then we can have mildly reasonable expectations. But when they become solid, that's where problems come in. Is that helpful at all?
I had an understanding of it. I'd just like to hear what you had to say about it.
Okay.
Healing people this week, just two people in general, just about how their father didn't express the love that they thought they needed, but in his way he was loving her, and she realized that, and other issues, but and just feeling worthiness. And if you don't get to that point and your expectations of that, then you feel not worthy of the end result of what you didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You explained it really well. I'm hoping everybody else got something out of it too.
I mean, one of the things that's true in just in our life in general, I think, is that we don't know. We're generally not very well aware of all of the impulses that are going on in our own mind. You know, sometimes we have an agenda which is even hidden from ourselves, right? So it's hard enough to know what our own agenda is, because there can be other subconscious ones that are forming our behavior. So it's hard enough to know completely, you know, without quite a measure of introspection of Dharma practice, of plumbing the nature of our own mind, seeing how our mind is working. Without doing that and becoming more and more skilled in that, it's hard to know what our own thoughts and feelings and motivations are in their complexity. There's a lot that are hidden from us. And then when we add to that, that in our relationships with someone else, we generate an expectation of how they should respond to what we've done. You know, then it's like it's even more uncertain, because at least we have some idea of the more obvious motivations and ideas and thoughts in our own mind. At least we have some idea of that. But how much do we know about what's really going on in the other person's mind? You know, like showing appreciation. One person's way of showing a lot of appreciation might be by doing such and such an action. It could be anything, like giving a gift or saying thank you or whatever it is, right? But it, for another person, because their background and their makeup, consciously and unconsciously, is different from ours, they may be showing appreciation, you know, but showing it in a way that we don't recognize. That it's valid for them. But if we don't know where they're coming from, we don't recognize it. We think, well, I thought this person was, I thought I did a good thing. I thought this person would thank me for it. But they didn't do anything. You know, oh, they sent me a Hallmark card. That's all they did, you know. Well, maybe for that person, that's a sign of great, you know, appreciation, great gratitude. It's just different from the way we would do it. So it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict.
This is on a practical level about the laziness of what I think is the laziness of busyness.
Yeah, yeah, busyness. That's a good word.
Turning, developing the motivation for those actions to sort of transform them. So a couple of things I need to do. Clean some bathrooms, mow the yard. So, like, practically, what is the mindset to develop as I approach those tasks, for instance?
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of an event which I didn't witness myself, but was reported. When I was living in Nepal, Lama Zopa left his room and picked up a broom and started sweeping the area just outside of Lama Yeshe's room. Right, and so. When Lama Zopa does something like that, you know, when he picks up a broom and starts sweeping, he's not just removing the dust from a particular area. You know? All of his activities are really the Bodhisattva's activities. So, it can be with thoughts such as I'm removing the dust, you know, may the way for my teacher to be able to benefit limitless beings be opened. Or just as I'm removing the dust, may any pollution obscuring the mind be removed. Or any similar fashion. So the actual action, whether it's cleaning the bathrooms or... I'm not quite sure at the moment how I would transform mowing the lawn, but there must be a similar way. You know, cutting the heads off the delusions. Right? In other words, you engage with a good concentration on whatever action you're doing, but you wed it, you know, you marry it to an activity that has benefit beyond just that physical action. And clearly, anything that relates to providing benefit will do that, will help do that. So I remember in one of the first, I think the first Kopan course that I took from Kepche Sopa Rinpoche, he talked about transforming ordinary daily activities. And he said, so when you open a door, think, I'm opening up the door to higher rebirth. And then when you pass it through and you close the door behind you, think, I'm closing the door to lower rebirths, you know, for all beings. Right? And each action that was done can be done by marrying it with this higher intention. It doesn't mean you're not paying attention to what you're doing. You see, that some people have that idea that if you think about something else, you're not paying attention to what you're doing. Actually, the opposite is true, because now this action is taking on a very powerful symbolic meaning. You pay more attention to it. You're just doing it with a broader, wider, deeper motivation. Just beyond the limit of this activity, you're tying it together with, you know, everything up to the welfare of all sentient beings, as we say in the prayers. So a lot of times it's just a matter of being creative, inventive. You know, this action I'm doing now, how could it be thought of as analogous to a bodhisattva's action. Like that. I think that we had something up here.
Oh, I'm thinking what you're saying, an action, whether it's cooking dinner or cleaning the bathroom. Isn't there a value in totally being into what you're doing? Whether it's the motion, whether it's the smell, where it's going. And I would even say that about mowing the yard. You know, you're out there, there's the beauty around you, there's nature, there's the air, the smells, all that. And so totally devoting yourself to what you're doing. Isn't that important?
It is important, and that's what I tried to say at the end, but maybe I didn't express myself very well, that doing actions with a wider, deeper motivation doesn't mean that you're not paying attention to the action itself. It means you actually allow yourself to pay deeper attention to it because it is so significant, you know? It's... Okay, here's the wrong way to do it. I'm the expert in the wrong way of doing things, okay? So let's say you're cleaning the bathroom and you're thinking, oh, this, you know, I should, it'd be good for me to connect this with the bodhisattva's action. So cleaning up the mind of all sentient beings, helping clean the mind of sentient beings while I'm cleaning the toilet, okay? It's like that. Well, if doing it the wrong way means you get caught up in your own fantasy of cleaning the mind of sentient beings, you know, and then you do a really lousy job cleaning the toilet, right? Because you're not paying attention to what you're doing, right? That's the wrong way. That would be the opposite of what you're saying, okay? But as you're engaging the action, it only takes a moment to think, may this action be beneficial to all beings, and then do the action, as the mother of a friend of mine used to say, straight up and down. In other words, you do it honestly, directly, kind of like the way a Zen master would advocate, you know, do it without wobbling, really pay attention, right? So setting the motivation doesn't mean you're ignoring what you're doing now. It sets the scope for really paying attention to what you're doing now. You're just doing it under the influence of this compassionate motivation. And in some teachings they talk about when you set the bodhicitta motivation for an action, you don't have to necessarily keep repeating it. If you cultivate a strong instance of it in the beginning, then your whole action is governed by that motivation. And so you have all the time left over. Everything but the first nanosecond can be devoted to really paying attention to what you're doing, mowing the lawn or cleaning the toilet and so forth.
So is the greater virtue in totally devoting yourself to the task or to multitask where you're doing the task but you're thinking on a higher level of...
No, I'm trying to explain, you don't multitask. You don't do one thing with your mind somewhere else.
Okay.
No, you don't want to do that. You want to cultivate as positive and as expansive a motivation as possible to have it impel your action, but paying attention to the action, not constantly forgetting what you're doing and going back up to the, you know, to your thought balloon over your head and looking back down on yourself. No, I think if you approach things with the proper motivation in the beginning, it's like we say at the teachings, you know, in a teaching situation, like any situation can be thought of as having three parts. You generate the motivation in the beginning. That impels the action, okay? Once the actual action, let's say the teaching or the listening, starts taking place, then the main thing is to focus on that action as uninterruptedly as possible, right? It isn't to stop in the middle and, you know, lose track of what you're doing and then go back and, revitalize, you know, your motivation. You might have to do that sometimes, but you don't want, you know, you want to mainly pay attention to what you're doing, right? And then at the conclusion, then you dedicate whatever, when the action comes to an end, you dedicate whatever positive energy for the aim that you originally cultivated in your motivation. So I don't think it's a matter of juggling things, you know, doing two things at once. There's an impulse, and then the action takes place with as much concentration and attention, mindfulness, as we can. I think that works out practically.
This kind of follows up on the expectation comments. In the Discovering Buddhism course, we talk about precious human rebirth. We talk about karma and collecting merits, either in this lifetime or eons over eons for our rebirths.
Yeah.
And in our handout here, we have a holy day coming up where Lama Zopa Rinpoche says our good actions will increase by 100,000 on that day.
Mm-hmm.
Without being flippant, probably failing at that, that reminds me of the ads I get for frequent flyer points.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy this particular credit card, you'll get 100,000 points, but if you don't buy it, you haven't a chance of ever accumulating enough points to get a free flight. And so I have two parts of the question. One, how do we know enough merits are enough to not come back as a cockroach or a dog or whatever? And secondly, who's counting anyway? Who decides whether we come back in the lower realms or as a human being?
Okay. Well, the first thing I'll say is, remember in the beginning I said there's certain questions that I can't answer? Well, I've never personally related to the idea that there are days that increases the value of the meritorious action 10 million times or 200,000 times or whatever it is for these big holidays, you know. It isn't something that I read or think about and intuitively strikes me as true. And the explanations for why it could be true, I personally don't find them convincing. I'm not saying I don't believe in them or that they can't be true. It's just it doesn't strike me with the strength of conviction. So you happen to ask a question in an area where I would be probably the worst person to try to answer. Okay. There is a value, though, I think, if on a particular day, let's say, I think the day that's coming up is Buddha's descent from Tushita heaven from teaching his mother. I think that's the one that's coming up. And the other ones are like his enlightenment and things like that. And on those days, at the very, very least, there may be something else going on that I'm just not aware of, but at the very, very least, if we turn our mind to what the significance of that day is, we think about an incredible action of compassion and wisdom that took place on that day. That day is commemorating. And also, at the same time in the world, many, many hundreds of thousands of people are also focusing on that. So there's just an appreciation of this very, very kind, very compassionate action that took place at the time of the Buddha. And so those shared thoughts of appreciation about what that holiday signifies, I could see how that could strengthen whatever you do on that particular day, because you're doing it kind of under the aegis of that action. That's one way that I can understand multiplying days. But beyond that, that explanation makes some sense to me, but beyond that, I just don't relate to it that well. Then the other part of the question is, who determines how much merit is enough? It's not like that. It's not like anybody outside of ourselves determines things. It's just that within the scope of the spiritual teachings, there's a place for what's known as collecting and cleansing. Is that a phrase that anyone here has heard? collecting and cleansing. It's often used in when the seven limb prayer is discussed. No? Okay. Well, I'm sorry, this answer may be a little bit longer than I intended. I'll try to shorten it in my mind. There's an analogy made to planting a crop, planting seeds in a field, and with the reasonable expectation of getting a crop at the end. So if you want to make that expectation as reasonable as possible, you really want to prepare the field first. So you have to do basically two things. One is you have to remove from the field everything that would interfere with the growth of that crop, and then you have to add to the field all the nutrients that would support the growth of that crop. Okay? So that's analogous for what we're doing with our mind. Here, the mind is the field in which we're trying to cultivate realizations, understandings of the various aspects of the spiritual path, right? And of course, in order to do that, we have to receive teachings and think about the teachings that we receive. But in order that the teachings that we receive and the meditations we do on it to be effective, we have to remove from the field of our mind everything that would interfere with the growth of those realizations and add to the nutrient level of the mind so it's to support them. So those two practices are cleansing the mind, right, and cultivating or collecting a positive energy, meritorious energy. So it's not like there's a limit to it, or it's not that someone else determines what we have to do, but we have to see, is there anything present in our mind which is preventing us from developing realizations even when we receive excellent teachings? Well, there could be, you know, there could be distraction, there could be the presence of really negative states of mind like anger, and if we approach the teachings with that kind of interferences like that, then even the most excellent teachings in the world aren't going to lead to realizations. And on the other hand, we need a certain strength. You know, we have to, you know, in a field you have to make sure there's fertilizer and water and adequate sunlight and all of those things. Otherwise, the best seeds in the world aren't going to grow into the crop. Well, similar fashion, we have to increase the strength of the mind through all the various virtuous practices, collecting virtue. So the collecting and cleansing practices, cleansing interferences, and then collecting what's often called meritorious energy. And there's this is an ongoing process. And in fact, in Lama Zopa's house in Aptos, one of the kind of slogans he has on the world, on the wall of a particular room, is a quotation from a great Lama who's saying, now, in this day and age, our main practice should not be meditation, it should be collecting and cleansing. You know? Because there's so many things interfering with the growth of realizations in our mind that until we get rid of a lot of that junk, you know, that's clogging the pipes, then we aren't going to fully receive the benefit of the teachings we do receive. And until we build up this nutrient strength of the mind, give it some, you know, a firm foundation in ethics, then again, the teachings that we receive aren't going to be beneficial or limited benefit. Now, having said this is the time for collecting and cleansing and not meditation, please don't go around quoting John Landau saying we don't have to meditate anymore. that was not the intention of that quotation. It was just showing the Lama was saying, you know, we have to recognize that we're living in a day and age when there's lots of interferences, and if we don't do something about those interferences, then just simply studying and meditating on the Dharma, as good as that is going to have limited benefit. So shifting the attention to the collecting and cleansing practices is important. That's all I mean to say by it. Right. Okay. Well, we do have 5 more minutes, so we could have a couple of more questions. Way back there, there's one.
This kind of goes on with the rebirth. My understanding is partly, even though we work so hard on our minds and cleansing and having better karma, that also at our time of death, where our mindset is very important.
Very important.
And yeah. Called throwing karma.
Exactly.
And so that might determine where we end up as well.
It does determine.
And I think if we've purified our mind and done a lot of work on it when we get to our death, I think the more practice we've done, maybe we've done better chance of having better throwing karma.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can you expand on that?
I don't know how to expand on it without being too expansive. Okay, so not everyone may be familiar with the terminology that was used in that question. Karma can be discussed in many different ways, but one aspect of karma is that which impels us to take rebirth, right? And that's called throwing karma. There's another that's called completion karma, and that determines that once we are reborn in a particular state of existence, the completing karma completes the attributes of that state, you know, the kind of family that we're born into, the environment, things like that, okay? But the throwing karma is what impels us to take rebirth in that realm, whether it's the human realm or which part of the human realm and so forth, okay? So that's throwing karma. So not every action that we do is throwing karma. Throwing karma is a particularly strong karma, something done with very strong intention. And also, this maybe starts to answer your question, the strength of throwing karma depends on a number of factors, and one of the main factors is familiarity or repetition. So let's say in our life we did something really bad once. I mean, really bad. You know? But we only did it once. And let's say we made some effort to purify it, and we're not quite sure how good a job we did, but we made some effort. But in that same lifetime, maybe as a result of feeling regretful for that one really bad negative action, we devoted ourselves over a long period of time to helping others in a particular way, maybe in a way that starts to undo that process of the harm that we did. Okay, so what we're building up then is we had this one negative karmic imprint, and then we had hundreds of not as powerful but very often repeated positive imprints. And in all likelihood, depending on the state of mind when we pass away, depending on various factors, the action that we did repeatedly will be the throwing karma that determines our next life, as opposed to something that we just did once or twice or something that we tried to purify. So not all throwing karmas are equal, you know. That which we did more frequently has a stronger impulse and has the stronger tendency of arising at the time of death and determining where the next rebirth is. Okay, but there are more extensive teachings about all the various factors that determine whether a particular karmic action is relatively heavy or relatively light. And the heavier ones have the greater preponderance of determining the next rebirth, and the lighter ones have a less chance of doing so. So that becomes a rather big process, but in the commentaries on the 12 links of dependent arising, then you get more detailed explanation of points like that. But of those various points, familiarity and repetition plays a huge part. Yeah. Is that helpful a little bit? Yeah. Okay. So, my goodness. Yeah. I didn't have too extensive an introduction, you know. That's I get an A+ for that. You know? I left time for questions at the end. Well, now I'm a little bit afraid. Doing so well this time, I'm afraid I'm going to fall into a fit of despair when it comes time to teach the next time. I can't possibly repeat such a performance of being actually have enough self-control to do what I intended to do.
Reasonable expectations.
Yes, to me it seems like all my expectations are unreasonable. Anyway, I'm just joking, folks. It's been very happy to be with you, and so we did do a motivation in the beginning. It was just relatively short and sweet. Right, and then we did try to pay attention to the main activity which you did, which was thinking about those four factors that increase the strength of the joyous perseverance, and then turning as to whatever extent we were capable of to the various questions and points of discussion. So now at the end, it's time to dedicate whatever positive energy may have been generated by each of us individually and by all of us collectively. And the reason for doing this, I mean, there's many reasons, but one of the main stated reasons for dedicating the energy is because if we don't dedicate it, it's very easy for another state of mind to arise later. Like if we're cut off in traffic, you know, and we get really pissed off at the person who cut us off in traffic, that moment of anger has a very destructive power, and it has the power to destroy all or much of whatever positive energy was on the mind previously. But when we dedicate it, the way my teachers have explained it, it's like putting it in a safe deposit box, right? So it won't be exhausted until enlightenment is attained. So we can dedicate this energy, whatever it may have been, thinking that we're emulating the practices of the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who, when they dedicate their positive energy, they try to keep in mind, or they do keep in mind, we have to try, they do keep in mind, that the three spheres of the dedication, meaning the person making the dedication, that's ourself, the recipients of the dedication, that's whatever we're focusing on, and the very act of dedication, that none of these three spheres has even an atom of concrete self-existence, but are mere dependent arisings. So with at least giving lip service to that wisdom consciousness, then we can dedicate this positive energy so that all beings may be released from their mental and physical sufferings. So that teachers such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Kepje Sopa Rinpoche and all others revealing true paths that lead to higher rebirth, liberation, and full enlightenment may be endowed with long, fruitful lifetimes, so that we may come under the benevolent care of such compassionate teachers in this and in all future states of existence, so that the enlightened beings currently inhabiting every corner of the universe may continue to turn the peerless wheel of the Dharma, and that we ourselves may complete our spiritual path as swiftly as possible in order to repay the infinite kindness we've received from each and every sentient being. And to that dedication, we can also think, may all of those beings who come to the Kadampa Center here in Raleigh, North Carolina, in search of mental, physical, or spiritual health and well-being, may have their wishes fulfilled just as they desire.
So just a quick reminder, if you weren't in the room earlier, that John will be here through this coming week. Tomorrow night he's teaching on how to meditate in the Discovering Buddhism class, and that's open to anyone. Wednesday night he'll be teaching on the foundation of all good qualities, which is a very nice, concise guide to spiritual practice. On Thursday, he's going to be talking about making pilgrimage to Buddhist holy sites. And Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, he'll be giving a little presentation on the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, and then he'll be back again next Sunday morning. And now Don has a very special announcement about a great opportunity coming up.
So thank you. So John, some of his comments sort of feed into what's getting ready to happen. The weekend of Thanksgiving, so it'll be actually Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 7 a.m. till 5 p.m. So we're gonna be doing a Lam Rim retreat. Now, a little context about this. Rinpoche, at the Light of the Path retreat, emphasized the importance, and John mentioned this earlier, that in any Dharma activity, the first thing to do is to set the motivation. So the end result of doing a Lam Rim retreat is having a really solid, if it's done well, some real sense of bodhicitta, or this awakening mind. So Rinpoche really emphasized at the Light of the Path that everything we do at Kadampa Center should be started out. We should always take a moment and set this motivation, make it clear that this is motivation for practice. So this is an opportunity. We haven't done this in literally decades, where we've taken 3 days to give ourselves an opportunity to really get these teachings, not only have them wash over us like a wave, but actually to bring them to the level of our heart-mind. And so the only way to really, well, there are other ways to do it, but I think meditation practice and doing a group retreat like this is a golden opportunity, one that we don't often get. So those of you who are interested don't have to be a Buddhist to do it, but you have to be willing to come to all 3 days. This is the only requirement. Start at 7, end at 5. Bring a light breakfast, bring a light lunch. There'll be breaks in between each meditation. There'll be some Q&A. And the whole intent is to create benefit. Just to create benefit in your mind and help us to get the plant deeply within our mind stream, the seeds of the Lam Rim, the stages of the path. So, and by the way, that's also what John's giving teaching this Wednesday on Foundation of All Good Qualities, which is a text, a Lam Rim text. Not sure how much you'll get through, but probably a lot. Also, I just want to say I've known John a long time. You know, we go back to the 80s, early 80s, and I think we're just amazingly fortunate to have someone who has had so many teachings and such experience. So when he says, and he's very humble about this, but when he speaks about the Dharma, he really is literally channeling Lama Yeshe, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and many, many teachers that he's had over the years. So I think we're so fortunate to have him. Please come back, John.